Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Our guest is John Borak. He's a veteran music journalist. He writes a lot about power pop music and a lot about the Beatles, but he's covered everything in his career. And the new book is called The Beatles, 100 Pivotal Moments in Beatles History. There are 100 chapters, each one, and these are in order of importance, according to John. Each one an interesting pivotal Beatles moment. So lots to read, lots to think about. And I think Beatles are in everybody's mind because of the new Get Back movie that everybody seems to have seen and everybody seems to have an opinion on. So it was just a pleasure to kind of just talk Beatles a little bit for a few minutes with somebody like John, who's done a lot of research, a lot of work on this. I do want to point out that Preston Niles of The Knack will be our guest in a few weeks in April. You can always check WFMU.org/Michael for the archives of past guests and the list of upcoming guests. And I also wanted to point out that our fundraiser, our yearly fundraiser, starts on the air for 2 weeks. It starts 2 weeks from now, and I hope some of you will pledge. Again, go to WFMU.org/Michael. You'll see a giant banner. Impossible to miss on the front of the page, and just click that. And if you pledge to this show, you can get yourself 4 brand new beverage coasters. They're beautifully illustrated, and they're heavy duty. They are literally the thickest beer coasters I could find, because once I got some thin ones and they kind of curled up and were very disappointing. So these are the thickest ones known to man. Again, appreciate your support of WFMU. Just head over to WFMU.org/Michael. Okay, The Beatles, 100 Pivotal Moments in Beatles History. It's me and John Borak. Enjoy, and talk to you soon. All right, there are The Beatles, and John Borak joins us, as I've been saying this morning. He is a veteran music journalist, a contributing editor to Goldmine, a power pop expert, a Beatles expert. John, good morning, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Michael. Great to be here.
I read your book. I really enjoyed your book. And before we get to that, I want to know what you thought about Get Back, because rarely has any sort of cultural thing sort of, you know, everybody watched it. Everybody talked about it. It really got, not that the Beatles, you know, needed a boost or anything, but I was amazed just how much people were drawn into it and, you know, so many reactions. What did you think from your expert point of view? What did you think about Get Back?
Well, you know, it's great to, well, first of all, it's great to have the Beatles being introduced to new generations of fans. You know, being that the series aired on Disney Plus, I'm sure a lot of people watched it who may not have watched it otherwise. Secondly, it's really cool to see them collaborating, having fun, joking around, being lighthearted, which, as you know, was the complete opposite of the original Let It Be film in 1970, which was pretty dour and pretty negative and just really a sort of a downer way for them to go out. So, you know, it was just fun to see them, the restored audio, the restored video, you know, sounds and looks great. The songs don't sound dated at all, you know, and by the time they got to the rooftop, it was like seeing it again it was like seeing it for the first time. And it was just the anticipation, you know, I was, you know, sitting there watching thinking, boy, I wonder how this is going to go, even though I knew how it went, you know, it was fun to see it all unfold. And, you know, I've been telling folks, because people have asked me, well, do you think the Let It Be film more accurately portrayed the Beatles as they were, or does the Get Back movie, you know, is that a more accurate portrayal? And I always tell folks, you know, like with most things, that the truth lies somewhere in the middle. They probably weren't as miserable as Let It Be made them look to be. And it probably wasn't, you know, probably wasn't so many fun and games going on as Get Back made it seem. So probably somewhere in the middle, but you know, just as a historical document, it was wonderful to watch, and you know, it'd be wonderful to watch over and over again, just for the little bits and pieces of, you know, John Lennon making quips and you know, Paul McCartney sitting there writing Get Back from scratch on his bass, and just all these great little moments.
Yeah.
Really, really cool.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it is, of course, whenever you edit any, you know, whatever they filmed, 8 million hours of film, and you edit it down even to 8, you're going to have a point of view of the people putting that together. And I agree, they definitely, it seemed like they were trying to make the Beatles change the history a little bit, which is, you know, allowable and part of it. But yes, the truth probably in the middle. So your book, The Beatles, 100 Pivotal Moments in Beatles History, there's sort of, and let me know if you disagree with this idea, there's sort of an absurdness that people's feelings can be quantified and put into a list of 100 things. And I think part of the conceit of the book is that it's really just a way for you to show your love of the Beatles and to get readers thinking and discussing and perhaps even disagreeing with you. And I think that's sort of part of the whole idea of the book.
Well, I think that's the part of any list in general. You know, it gets people engaged. It gets people talking. They agree. They disagree. You know, the publisher mentioned, you know, one of the things that they put out there to promote the book was John Borak has written a book to agree with and disagree with. And, you know, that's what it is. It's one person's opinion. My opinion of the 100 most pivotal moments in Beatles history, you know, ranked 1 to 100 in what I feel is the order of importance. But, you know, like any list, it's completely subjective. And, you know, as I said, it's one person's opinion. But I had a lot of fun writing it and a lot of fun researching it. You know, I tried to find a lot of quotes that weren't the ones you hear over and over and over again, like, you know, John's Aunt Mimi saying, guitar's all right, John, but you'll never earn your living by it. Well, how many times have we all read that quote? You know, so I tried to dig a little deeper and find some quotes that maybe were a little bit more off the beaten path. So that was one of the fun things about putting this book together as well.
I think there's sometimes, and sometimes we come across it in, I come across it doing this radio show, there are fans who consider that any negative idea that is expressed, no matter how true it is a sign that, you know, you don't love the Beatles. And so there's always controversy when you express something negative about this thing that people just love so much, and rightfully so. But, and one of the things I liked about the book is that you didn't shy away from that. There are things you say that you must have known people were just going, even if they're true, it was just going to hurt people's feelings, you know? Did anyone threaten your life? You know, anything like that? Any blowback?
Not yet. But you know, it's still early in the process, so you never know. But the Beatles, although, you know, certainly my favorite group of all time and what I consider to be the finest rock and roll group of all time, you know, while they are certainly up there, they are not infallible. No one is. And they made a lot of missteps. And the book covers, by the way, the Beatles as a group, but also their solo careers. So sprinkled in among the 100 pivotal moments are, you know, pivotal moments from John, Paul, George, and Ringo after the band split and they went solo. So one of the solo moments I mentioned that was definitely not a high point was George Harrison's 1974 U.S. tour, which by all accounts was not his finest hour. His voice was gone. He was sort of preaching to audiences, telling them to be quiet and listen to the Indian music that was the opening act, and basically lecturing. And he rearranged a lot of the songs. He did Beatles songs and changed the lyrics, which is, you know, something close to sacrilege, really. You know, he was singing, he did In My Life, and instead of In My Life, I Love You More, he was singing In My Life, I Love God More. He was singing Something, which, of course, one of his classic tunes from the Beatles. But, you know, he was in the middle of a pretty bad breakup with his wife at the time, Patty Boyd. So instead of, you know, instead of the love song that Something was written as, you know, Something in the Way She Moves, he was singing When Something's in the Way We Move It. And, you know, that's not what people wanted to hear. You know, it was the first really major solo tour from an ex-Beatle on U.S. turf. So it was a disappointment. So, yeah, not infallible. And, you know, you go back to when they were together as a group and you look at the Magical Mystery Tour film. That was one of the more spectacular failures of their career. Of course, the music was wonderful. You know, the soundtrack, but the film itself was, it's interesting. I watched it again after not having seen it for several years. I watched it with my daughter a few years ago. I think she was probably 18 at the time. And we sat there and we watched it. And as soon as it ended, I looked at her and she looked at me and she said, Dad, that was really, really weird. And that's probably the best way I could describe it. It was just this rambling, halfway incoherent sort of mess, but you know, those moments obviously are few and far between, but they are there.
Yeah, weird is the perfect word there. You mentioned that there's a lot of quotes. At one point, Ringo, I think, is quoted about Paul McCartney's Ram I think he says something like he just wasted his time or something like that. And I had never heard that before.
Yeah, just wasting his time. There's not one single tune on there. And you know, I think that, you know, at that point in time, you know, that wasn't coming from a place of real music criticism. That was coming from a place of, hey, this guy's suing us and he's screwing us and there's all this bad blood. So it was, you know, it was the same thing John Lennon was doing at the time. And, you know, George Harrison did from time to time. It was just saying stuff in the press to kind of tweak each other. But, you know, deep down, they really loved each other. I look at it, it's, you know, it's like family. It's like brothers. You know, you argue, you may say some hurtful things from time to time, but at the end of the day, you really love each other. I think they did.
Let's talk for a minute about Chapter 42, Beatles for Sale. That's a record, in some ways, it is a light sort of record. You know, it's not full of the most incredible Beatle compositions, but it's a record I turn to often. I don't know, something about it I love. I mean, I love every one of them, but I love that record. Mm-hmm. What's your take?
Well, you know, that was sort of, you know, I think I subtitled that chapter A Musical Retreat of Sorts. Because they were so busy at that time, you know, 1964, they had conquered America. They had released all these records. They had done the Hard Day's Night movie. And, you know, the soundtrack to A Hard Day's Night in the UK was the first ever Beatles album with all original compositions on it. There were no covers. But then when they went to Beatles for Sale, they sort of dug back into this stash of covers they had performed live over the years before they really became big. For the most part, every Beatles album was a step in a different direction or a move forward. And that one seemed like, you know, maybe a sidestep or maybe even a little step back. But you know, having said that, I'm not saying it's a bad album. Certainly not. There's some wonderful material on there. No Reply, for example, is just an amazing song, particularly the bridge. And I, you know, I've discussed this with a friend of mine, and we've both said, I really wish they would have done that bridge in the song more than once because it's so amazing. You know, and then, you know, of course, 8 Days a Week was on there, which was a single here, but not in the UK. Babies in Black was sort of a kind of a dark little waltz. And you know, so certainly solid. But, you know, looking at it from the perspective of, well, are they growing as a band? Not as much as maybe, you know, from there they went on to Rubber Soul, then Rubber Soul to Revolver. That's more of kind of a progression. This I didn't see that. Beatles for Sale is too much of a progression for them, but still a great record.
Yeah, agree. Let me just remind folks that our guest this morning is John Borak, and the book is called The Beatles 100, 100 Pivotal Moments in Beatles History. And there's a link on today's playlist on a place where you can get yourself an autographed copy from the publisher, Rare Bird. One of the chapters that I thought was a real smart idea to include was the release of the Red and the Blue albums, as I call them, which were these sort of two, a little bit like Endless Summer. They were two greatest hit double albums that got released and both made the charts in 1973.
Oh, yeah. And that, you know, that again brought the Beatles to sort of a whole new generation. If you weren't there when the Beatles were a functioning group and you were coming in a little later, like I was actually at that time, when those came out, I was probably 11, 12 years old. So that was, you know, one of my first introductions to the band in terms of full length records. And I think it was that way for a lot of people. And kind of the reasoning behind it, the reason why they even did it in the first place, or one of the reasons, was because there was a bootleg, I think it was called Alpha Omega, this little like six LP box set being advertised on television, which was pretty ballsy thing to do. But I guess, you know, more people could get away with that at that time than you certainly couldn't get away with that now. But, you know, the Beatles, you know, team saw this was selling. And so they, of course, did a cease and desist. Apple did a cease and desist. And then they thought, well, you know, let's put out our own just to kind of counteract this. So that was one of the reasons why they did the 62 through 66 and 67 through 70 compilations. But it was weird. The Alpha Omega set that was released was so out there in terms of song sequencing and track choices, because it also had some solo material on there as well. So, for example, you would get Wah Wah by George Harrison from All Things Must Pass. And immediately after that, you'd hear the Beatles doing Long Tall Sally, which was just a really bizarre sort of thing. Yeah, Alan Klein was their manager at the time, and you know, he was pretty lawsuit happy. So he filed lawsuits against the company that released it, the television affiliates who aired the commercials, and the whole nine yards. So yeah, it was only about 1 month after that the quote unquote authorized collections came out.
I'd never even heard of that Alpha Omega collection. I'll have to see if I'm curious to see what it even looks like. Yeah, I got both of those for Christmas 1 year, and it totally, you know, just ate them up. Amazing. And yet at that point, you couldn't certainly get the UK versions of the records. It was, you know, years until you could sort of get the whole Beatles catalog together, which is kind of mind-blowing. I'd like to end up by playing, and at the end of the book, you list your favorite Beatles songs, and number two is "And Your Bird Can Sing." And I thought, that's a great one. We'll hear the version from the Beatles anthology, which is very interesting. And in the liner notes, they say in a sort of roundabout way that perhaps the Beatles have taken some substances that are making them act silly in the studio.
Oh, they, you know, John and Paul particularly were giggling their way through the entire thing after there was a little flub. You know, when you hear it, you just hear them cracking up throughout the entire thing. And I'm sure there was something involved that helped it be a little more humorous to them than it probably actually would have been to other people. But it's just, you know, no matter the case, it's just great to hear them laughing and having fun. And, you know, the joy behind the Beatles, I think that's one of the things that people love so much about their music. There's a real spirit of happiness and joy behind most of the material. You know, Paul McCartney even said once, you know, we're not a band that wrote songs about, you know, go out and you know, forget your parents, you know, do this and do this. And, you know, because we wrote about love and peace and all you need is love and I love her and, you know, that sort of thing. So the messages, for the most part, were really positive. And I think that's what helps the band be, you know, still so popular today.
Yeah, I agree. And also, this track just totally cooks. It's just an crazy, amazing studio concoction. John Borick, thanks for spending some time with us this morning. The book is called 100 Pivotal Moments in Beatles History, available wherever you get your books. And like I said, there's a link on the website to get yourself an autographed copy. Thanks, John, and let's hear the Beatles.
Thank you, Michael. Take care.
One, two, three, four. You tell me that you've got everything you want, and your bird can sing, but you don't get me. You don't get me. You can't see me.
When your prizes start to weigh you down, look in my direction, I'll be round, I'll be round. You tell me that you've heard every sound there is, and your bird can swing, but you can't hear me. You can't hear me. When your bike is broken, will it bring you down? You may be a woman, I'll be wrong.
Tell me that you've got everything you want, and your bird can sing, but you don't get me. You don't get me.